The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Brandy Spergotta for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Oprah Magazine. Our first article by Lane Dalphin is titled, What It Means to Dream of Being Stuck in a Maze. I dreamed that one morning I woke up in my New York City apartment to find that the building's external wall had completely fallen off, exposing the outside world and busy streets below. As I looked out from the edge of my sixth-floor apartment, I realized that it was no normal morning, but the morning of the New York City Marathon, a race that I was registered for this coming fall. I instantly panicked, knowing I'd missed the start of the race. But as I stood looking out, clutching the edge of my building and my running sneakers, I realized that the runners were racing through a hamster-like maze instead of the normal course. The streets were stacked on top of each other, rising into the sky one by one, connected like a loop that took them from top to bottom over and over again. They sprinted up each level, crazily climbing over top of one another, to continue on to a finish that never existed. Suddenly, I felt like I wasn't so sad about missing out. Signed, Maze Runner. Dear Maze Runner, your dream is filled with surprises. You're surprised to see the outside wall of your building had completely fallen off. You're shocked to realize it's the morning of the New York City Marathon, and what's worse, you've missed the beginning. And then you discovered that the race route is a hamster-like maze. Amidst all the surprises, I'm drawn to how you move from the panic and sadness of missing the start of the race, where you first say you really wanted to be, to deciding that you're not sad after all, knowing there's no end to this race. If this was my dream, that's where I'd begin. Your maze reminds me of how I feel sometimes after I finish cleaning my house. Under the surface, I know this job is going to present itself again and again. It's a job that just doesn't get done and stay done, or, as you say, it continues to a finish that never existed. Is there a job or situation in your life recently in which you feel that no matter how high you climb, there's no finish line? I chose job first in my question because, as you describe it, they sprinted up each level, crazily climbing over top of one another. That brings a corporate ladder to mind. For some people, work can have a never-ending quality to it. Once they reach a goal, they are already looking at what's next. Are you the style of person who is more focused on what's ahead than taking a breath of appreciation for where you've arrived? Here's another point. In your dream, you had actually registered for the race. You planned for it. To help connect to the recent waking event that triggered this dream, ask yourself if your job or some other recent situation presents a scenario that you'd planned for at the start, but afterwards felt like you would somehow miss the beginning. Moreover, this dream feels like it could be describing a situation that begins with intensity. After all, it's the New York City Marathon, but later you lose your motivation and realize you don't want to do it. Alternately, might this be a conversation you're having with yourself about a certain relationship? We all know how a relationship can start with a bang. Once the honeymoon phase is over and a few months go by, reality with your partner starts to set in. Might you be questioning if you want to stay the course, metaphorically? Expanding this thought, could you have missed the start of the marathon because you didn't take the time to really look at the person you'd started to date? If that resonates with you, perhaps you're beginning to feel like your partner's qualities are the type that will never change and that you don't like the idea this race may not end. Now let's look at the surprise of waking up to find the outside wall of your building has completely fallen off, exposing the outside world. Do you feel there's some truth or reality about the outside world that was recently exposed to you? I like how this realization occurs to you after the race has started, but before you join in. Though you're alarmed at first, you soon realize that it isn't a situation that you want to be a part of. Perhaps this dream is an early call to pay attention to whatever waking situation your unconscious is discussing. Very often, a dream delivers a solution right there in the plot. Here, it's the finish that is missing, literally. That's your unconscious mind encouraging you to fill in the blanks. You can look to your feelings to find the best conclusion. If this is career-related, a good question might be, is this where I want to be? If your current dilemma concerns a relationship, the question can be, is this someone I want to be with long term? The answer to either of those questions will bring you right to the finish line. Our next article by Jessica Zucker and Sarah Gaines Levy is titled, Breast Cancer is Not a Battle to Fight. Anyone who has had breast cancer knows how quickly the comments start. They come in the moment you receive your diagnosis from your doctor, as soon as you begin telling friends and family members, the second you start poking around online looking for community support. You're a warrior. You'll beat this. Fuck cancer. You've got this. Instantly, you are deemed strong and a fighter, says Chanel Bryant, 38, who was diagnosed with stage 2 triple negative breast cancer at 36. It's as though it's part of the diagnosis, regardless of what kind of person you were before entering that doctor's office. Indeed, these sentiments represent the prevailing narrative when it comes to facing a breast cancer diagnosis. There are 4.7 million posts tagged hashtag fuck cancer on Instagram. Because the terminology is almost automatic, it's seen as unusual if you don't adopt it. It's everywhere, whether you like it or not. It hasn't always been this way. As Howard Walensky wrote in an op-ed for MedPage Today, up until the mid-1980s, patient and victim were far more common descriptors than survivor or warrior. An influential 1985 essay in the New England Journal of Medicine, Seasons of Survival, Reflections of a Physician with Cancer, aimed to transform cancer victims into cancer survivors, Walensky writes. A few years later, in 1993, the Atlanta Journal-Constitution covered a performance by activist Sharon J. Lang called Women with Breast Cancer Are Warriors. The piece was in a showcase by queer Atlantans called Together, Proud, and Strong. At the time, the stance of the monologue was radical. It's hard to pinpoint exactly what caused the proliferation of the term between the 90s and now, but some of it may be due to the increase in survivorship, and therefore an increase in the number of people who need a language to talk about these experiences. Per the American Cancer Society, which it should be noted employs the use of a sword in its logo, during the 1970s, about one of two people diagnosed with cancer survived at least 5 years. Now, more than two of three survive that long. The narrative dominance of these warlike terms may also come from our cultural tendency to skew difficult emotions, to find a way to flip the script and search for a more positive angle, and to offer agency to people who feel as though that's been taken away at diagnosis. The genesis is understandable, but what is most interesting is how quickly this metaphor has become almost societally innate. Of course, for some, this rallying cry is motivational, a summons to gather the fortitude to face the diagnosis head-on, perhaps much the same way some people feel inspired by a coach shouting at them toward progress. But for others, this language doesn't necessarily resonate or feel reflective of their experience. Some find the label of warrior to be laborious. There's kind of a societal belief that cancer is a physical state that can actually be defeated, explains Meredith Camarada, LCSW, an oncology social worker at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. I think sometimes it comes from a need to gain control over something that most of the time is completely out of one's control. But for those that don't relate to this perspective, hearing this message constantly can make the already complex experience of having breast cancer even more isolating, confounding, and depleting. I could never get comfortable with the idea that people considered me a fighter or warrior against a thing I had very little control over, says Rasi Govindani, 40, who was diagnosed with stage 3A estrogen-positive breast cancer 5 years ago. Which means this labeling can lead to a kind of cognitive dissonance that quickly takes hold. If I was having a rough day, a day where I didn't get out of bed, was I living up to this warrior title? Ali Brummel, 32, recalls asking herself that after she was diagnosed with stage 2 triple negative breast cancer at 28. Many of the women we spoke to felt that this pressure and the messages surrounding it is too binary for the profundity and messiness that is breast cancer. It felt like an attempt to fit me and my story into a box, Brummel says. This sentiment is common. By categorizing people into brave and warrior, what this unintentionally does is tell the person how they should cope and how they should feel. It takes away from the person being able to describe their own feelings or their own individual experience with cancer, says Camerata. This framework also sets up a false dichotomy that the enemy in this metaphoric war is your own body, as the cancer and its home and your breasts are inextricably linked. We are not soldiers with weapons going to war with our bodies. It's not like I could go to the gym 5 days a week and somehow develop cancer-killing muscles, says Govindani. I didn't think my body got cancer just to piss me off. Caitlin Schenck, 35, who was diagnosed with stage 3 invasive ductal carcinoma last year, agrees. I'm not trying to fight against my body, she says. I'm trying to work with it. Not to mention, this battle-laden premise leans on some very dangerous thinking if you start imagining the outcome of the so-called war. It doesn't win. Everyone's body fights it. Some bodies fight it better than others. But no one loses the battle. That makes it seem like they didn't fight hard enough, as if they didn't want to live as badly as those of us who are still here, says Mary Rosales, 42, who was diagnosed with stage 2 invasive ductal carcinoma at 29. Camerata sees the repercussions of this thinking frequently with her patients. This narrative tends to assume that someone's positive attitude alone can actually defeat the cancer, and we know that's not true. Not to mention, the very idea of fighting in a marathon-length experience is daunting beyond belief. And breast cancer, from abnormal mammograms, sonograms, multiple MRIs and awaiting results, to diagnosis, countless appointments, potential surgery, treatment, and the treatment's many side effects, is already depleting physically, mentally, and emotionally. I didn't want to fight. I wanted to curl up in bed and pretend I wasn't living this nightmare, says Govindani. Gearing yourself up for a fight that isn't optional and that you still can't fully wrap your head around is taxing enough. And for some people who aren't comforted by the warrior language, there is an additional layer of complexity added to this already intense, soul-crushing exhaustion, having to keep up the facade of being a fighter for the sake of those around them. Friends and family often fear that any indication that the fight is too much for you is akin to letting the cancer win. I can remember letting people use words like fighter and survivor even when they didn't resonate with me because it made them feel better, and I didn't have the energy to deal with cancer and deal with people's feelings, says Govindani. Patients invariably end up doing unwanted emotional labor alongside having to navigate their own already challenging feelings, a brutally unfair arrangement. I've always been a strong person, but cancer is not the reason I am strong, Bryant says. It was exhausting having to go along with that constant dialogue in seemingly every human interaction that involved a discussion around my cancer. When people called me a warrior or kept going on about how strong I was, at times I would say, it's not like I have another option. But a lot of the time I didn't have the energy or mental capacity due to chemo brain to clearly articulate this, she explains. I found myself working very hard to make other people comfortable, says Rosales. That is an exhausting way to live. This approach can also end up creating feelings of isolation. If people around you keep saying things that don't feel right to you, you may end up retreating inward. Anytime someone else narrates or defines your own experience, it feels invalidating, says Camerata. When you name the way a group of people should cope with something, and I find that a lot of my patients do feel pressure to fight or stay positive from well-meaning family and friends, you feel invalidated by them. And what I see is it actually leads to more emotional suffering and makes people feel more alone. Another unintended possible consequence of the fighter narrative is that it may reinforce some ill-conceived notions about what strength actually means, namely that it involves suppressing vulnerable emotions in favor of stoicism. I hated so much that the best way to make other people comfortable was to put on a brave face, says Rosales. I wanted to cry and be depressed and just be held. And who says that isn't bravery? To me, being brave and strong is the ability to recognize feelings, be aware of them, and talk about them, says Camerata. By sending a message that strength is equivalent to emotional suppression, we may actually be cheating people out of an opportunity to do true processing. So if this paradigm doesn't serve everyone with breast cancer, what are the alternative ways to talk about it? Since the fighter narrative is so dominant culturally, Camarada says that dynamic language may be a helpful alternative. What feels right for you? How do you want to get through this, she asks. What tools have you used in the past to help with really difficult circumstances? There is no right or wrong way to cope with cancer. Your approach can also be ever-changing. What resonates with you now may not in 3, 6, or 9 months. For example, navigating works for me, says Govindani. It doesn't promise smooth sailing. It doesn't place responsibility on me to get through things a certain way. And crucially, it doesn't imply an endpoint. This idea of conquering for survivors sends the message that whatever you are fighting is in the past, says Bermel. Yet when we're talking about cancer, even if you are finished with active treatment, cancer will likely continue to be a very large part of your life. The appointments, the trauma, the fear of recurrence, the new sense of self. And what patients say over and over again is that they just want that ongoing instability understood compassionately. I honestly don't want to be called anything, says Rosales. Call me by my name and tell me you will listen to me complain, cry, laugh, scream, whatever. Openness is medicine. Vulnerability is medicine. She adds that there are other ways to save each other beyond being tough. We can also do it by being soft, says Govindani. Being broken open and being met right there is a kind of magic. Our next article by Oprah Winfrey is titled, Celebrate the 25th Anniversary of Oprah's Book Club with a Look Back at These Memorable Moments. You've heard me say many times that authors are my rock stars. From the time I was a little girl, books have guided me. They've helped me see and understand the world and myself. I can't count the number of aha moments I've had while reading. Through authors who became my touchstones, Maya Angelou, Alice Walker, Toni Morrison to start, I realized over and over again that I'm not alone, that others have gone through similar things to what I had. And then there are the writers who opened my eyes to new cultures or new ideas, like Eckhart Tolle, Isabel Wilkerson, and John Steinbeck. I owe a deep debt of gratitude to all the brilliant minds over the decades who have led me to conclude, there is no best life without books. I was inspired to start Oprah's Book Club 25 years ago after a producer at the Oprah Winfrey Show, Alice McGee, and I began exchanging favorite books and discussing what we thought of them. When she suggested that we formally bring that kind of conversation to our show, I said, great idea. I was thrilled to meet the writers whose books I was savoring, to find out more about their influences and creative processes, and to play a role in supporting them by exposing their work to a larger audience. But what has been most meaningful to me all this time is the opportunity Oprah's Book Club affords me to connect with fellow bibliophiles all over the world. I love listening to and learning from their insights as we read a book together. They'll shed light on plot points or passages I'm having trouble decoding. And when I read a sentence I'm over the moon about, or when something happens to a character I've come to care about, I'm always thrilled to see there are others out there who are experiencing the same. So it's you, dear readers, who have jazzed me up and kept me inspired. Without you, there is no Oprah's Book Club. Thank you for sharing this passion with me for the last 25 years and for many more to come. Number 1, The Deep End of the Ocean, 1996. On September 17th, Oprah announced the creation of Oprah's Book Club, with Jacqueline Machard's novel as her first selection. Oprah invited viewers to read along, and the book rocketed to the top of the bestseller lists. A book club was born. Number 2, Song of Solomon, 1996. Oprah's second pick was one of her all-time favorites, Song of Solomon by Toni Morrison. Oprah revered Morrison's work, but knew some would find it challenging, but ultimately life-altering. 4 viewers were selected to attend a dinner hosted by Oprah in Chicago, with Morrison as honored guest. Deep discussions ensued, and tears, too. Number 3, The Heart of a Woman, 1997. The 7th Oprah Book Club pick was authored by Maya Angelou. Oprah and several hand-picked audience members gathered for dinner at Angelou's home in North Carolina, where they were treated to smothered chicken prepared by the author. A slumber party followed, where all wore matching PJs. Number 4, A Lesson Before Dying, 1997. For this novel by Ernest J. Gaines, Oprah traveled to Point Coupee Parish, Louisiana, to tour the plantation where the author, a fifth-generation member of his sharecropper family, grew up. Number 5, Paradise, 1998. This was the second Toni Morrison novel Oprah selected for Oprah's book club. After the announcement, Oprah and 20 viewers set off for Princeton University to attend a special seminar taught by Morrison just for them. Number 6, Midwives, 1998. After selecting this novel by Chris Beaujolin, Oprah sat down with the author in Vermont, where the book is set. Number 7, White Oleander, 1999. Make some time. This is a tour de force, a friend told Oprah of the Janet Fitch book. She was so right, says Oprah. I savored every word. My favorite sentence? I missed beauty. Number 8, Where the Heart Is, 1998. Up to this point, most Oprah Book Club picks had been feted at lavish dinners. But for Billy Lett's novel, the event was held at a Walmart snack bar outside Chicago, where Oprah donned the company uniform. Why? The superstore figures into the plot of this debut by Lett, who started writing in her 50s. The book went on to sell 3 million copies. Number 9, Vinegar Hill, 1999. After A. Manette Ansay's first novel, Vinegar Hill, was Oprah's choice in November of 99, the author, long confined to a wheelchair with a mysterious chronic illness, was finally able to pay for treatments that would help her walk again, thanks to royalties earned from the resulting book sales. Number 10, A Map of the World, 1999. This novel was the second Jane Hamilton title Oprah chose. The first was The Book of Ruth. Sigourney Weaver, who starred in the film version of A Map of the World, attended the Oprah Book Club dinner at the Harpo Studios in Chicago. Number 11, East of Eden, 2003. Oprah's Book Club, which took a brief hiatus after April 2002, hit the road in June 2003 to explore Steinbeck Country, California, when Oprah announced the selection of John Steinbeck's classic. Number 12, Night, 2006. Holocaust survivor Elie Wiesel's masterpiece, originally published in English in 1960, is an account of his time in the Nazi death camps Auschwitz and Buchenwald. After Oprah picked it, she traveled to Auschwitz to tour with Wiesel. She also asked high school students to submit essays about what Night meant to them. 50,000 submitted essays and 50 lucky essayists received $10,000 college scholarships. Number 13, Freedom, 2010. Some are surprised when Freedom by Jonathan Franzen was chosen for Oprah's book club. 9 years earlier, when his novel The Corrections was picked by Oprah, the author publicly voiced his ambivalence at the opportunity and ended up not appearing on The Oprah Winfrey Show to discuss it. This time, the author was happy to sit down with Oprah to talk about his follow-up novel. Number 14, A New Earth, Awakening to Your Life's Purpose, 2008. For this Eckhart Tolle title, which Oprah says was a life changer, a wholly new approach to the selection was conceived. The author and Oprah went digital, producing a 10-episode series of live interactive discussions. Number 15, Anna Karenina, 2004. With Leo Tolstoy's classic, Oprah not only got 1 million Americans to read a Russian novel, they stayed engaged over hundreds of pages and then talked about it, Oprah says. That was the test, and they did it. Number 16, A Million Little Pieces, 2005. After Oprah selected this memoir by James Frey, which supposedly chronicled the author's dramatic history of drug and alcohol addiction, allegations surfaced that the writer had embellished and falsified his life story. She invited him back on The Oprah Winfrey Show, where she told him she felt duped, but more importantly, I feel that you betrayed millions of readers. Number 17, The Measure of a Man, 2007. When Oprah chose Sidney Poitier's candid memoir for Oprah's book club, 4 very fortunate audience members got to join the two icons for a dinner in L.A. Number 18, Wild, 2012. Wild by Cheryl Strayed was the first book to be named for Oprah's Book Club 2.0, the new iteration that began in 2012, following the end of The Oprah Winfrey Show a year earlier. Number 19, The Underground Railroad, 2016. Oprah fell in love with Colson Whitehead's reimagining of the road to freedom within the first few chapters. The book went on to win both the National Book Award and the Pulitzer Prize for Fiction. Number 20, The Sun Does Shine, How I Found Life, Freedom, and Justice, 2018. While visiting the office of Brian Stevenson, author of Just Mercy and founder of the Equal Justice Initiative in Montgomery, Alabama, Oprah noticed a copy of this book by Anthony Ray Hinton and snapped it up. The memoir recounts Hinton's decades-long imprisonment on death row after being wrongly convicted of two murders. Number 21, Becoming, 2018. Oprah and Michelle Obama came together in conversation around Becoming, whose sales set publishing records. The event took place at the Hearst Tower, where a group of local high school girls were surprised with the chance to be in the audience, followed by the opportunity to meet the former First Lady and Oprah. Number 22, The Water Dancer, 2019. The selection of Ta-Nehisi Coates' The Water Dancer was the first Oprah Book Club pick in partnership with Apple. It was launched with a billboard in Times Square, followed later by a vibrant conversation between Oprah and Coates in front of a live audience at the Apple Carnegie Library in Washington, D.C. Number 23, American Dirt, 2020. The announcement that Janine Cummins' novel would join the Oprah Book Club canon prompted an important conversation about cultural appropriation. Critics asked whether an American author who had not publicly referenced Latinx heritage prior to the book's publication had the right to publish a book whose plot and protagonists are Mexican. Oprah brought together the author, the publisher, and a room full of readers for a passionate discussion that aired as a special on Apple TV+. Number 24, Hidden Valley Road, 2020. Oprah was blown away by Robert Kolker's Hidden Valley Road, the true story of a family with multiple members of one generation diagnosed with schizophrenia. Her pick led to a larger dialogue around how mental illness is perceived and treated in our society. Number 25, Cast, 2020. Amid COVID-19 and in the wake of George Floyd's murder, Oprah was transfixed by Isabel Wilkerson's masterpiece, which offers a whole new way of seeing America's racial inequality. Oprah and the author engaged in a series of conversations around the topic, which was made into a Webby Award-winning podcast. Our next article by Martha Beck is titled, How Can I Socialize More When It Makes Me So Uncomfortable? I've never been the most social person, but the pandemic really did me in. It was like I had finally found enough alone time. Now I feel like I have an opportunity to be different, or at least make different choices and potentially change my life. Since the spring, I've been trying to go out more with friends, but I can't shake the anxiety and discomfort I feel in group settings. I've even skipped a few outings, thinking I just needed a break, but then I feel left out and even a little depressed. I really want to broaden my social circle. How do I continue to leave my comfort zone, even though that feels stressful? Company and solitude are like nutrients. We all need both of them, but in varying amounts. An extrovert may need lots of interaction and just a little solitude to feel balanced. You seem to be more of an introvert, which means that your health depends on getting a nice big dose of solitude every day, along with enough social interaction to feel connected. Notice that the solitude you experienced during the pandemic unexpectedly satisfied an unmet need. It sounds almost as if you managed to quench a kind of long-felt thirst, but you don't mention craving more time with people these days, just feeling left out and depressed when you take a solitude break. That doesn't sound like a need for more company. It's just the fear of missing out, which is very different. Our lives are far happier when we focus on doing what we love as opposed to simply avoiding what we fear. You love having time for solitude, but fear being left out. Do you see the difference? Try this. When you fear you're not social enough, take a few deep breaths. Come back to a state of calm and notice if you long to be with others. If you do, then it's time to reach out and connect. If you don't, if you're only acting on vague nervousness that you need to be more extroverted, keep giving yourself the gift of solitude. If you practice focusing on operating from love rather than fear, you'll eventually find the balance point between company and space that's perfect for you. Then you can establish a rhythm with friends and loved ones that keeps you at your happiest. You'll be happy when you're with people and happy when you aren't. And that's the way your life is meant to feel. Our next article by Lisa Arbetter is titled, How to Find the Right Kind of Therapy for You. Laura, a self-proclaimed feelings nerd, started seeing a therapist proactively before the birth of her daughter as a precaution against postpartum depression. Unfortunately, after only a few sessions, the therapist abruptly left the practice. Before Laura, last name withheld for privacy, could find someone new, her father fell gravely ill with COVID-19. As an only child, Laura had to manage coordinating his care, and his medical decisions fell to her to handle, all while 7 months pregnant and working. And, as is protocol with COVID patients, she couldn't even be at her father's bedside to comfort him as he passed away. I wanted to lie on the couch, cry, and feel all the feelings, says the 29-year-old. But between planning the memorial, managing his affairs, and taking care of a newborn, grieving for my dad became something that had to happen in small pockets, like in the 5 minutes I had to shower. Around this time, she stumbled upon Wobot, a chatbot therapy app. Though Laura had been skeptical when she first heard of AI therapy, now, amid a crisis, she was willing to give it a try. She responded to a few prompts, and the app recognized she was grieving. It then asked her to describe her dad and her feelings about his death. I realized that no one had asked me those questions and how badly I needed to answer them, says Laura. I was able to put into writing how wonderful my dad was and how much I miss him. It felt like a weight was lifted. Wobot is but one example of how technology is changing the face of mental health care. Psychedelic drug treatments are coming to the fore, and interactive mind-body therapies such as EMDR, or eye movement desensitization and reprocessing, and somatic experiencing, or SE, continue to be used. Therapy no longer just means lying on a couch talking about your childhood, and the hope is the field's evolutions will make mental health help available to more people in more areas. It shouldn't come as a surprise. People are stressed out right now. Here in the U.S., before the pandemic, an estimated 11% of adults reported symptoms of anxiety and depression. As of June 2021, that number has climbed to 30%, according to data from the National Center for Health Statistics and the Census Bureau. But it's not just COVID worrying us. This past year has been very stressful for many in terms of a reckoning with racial justice issues and the political turmoil, says Lynn Bufka, Ph.D., the American Psychological Association's Senior Director of Practice Transformation and Quality. Layer on top of that the fact that over 100 million Americans live in rural areas, which due to lack of funding or infrastructure have a shortage of mental health professionals, less than one per 30,000 residents, and you have the perfect petri dish for growing a mental health crisis. Technology provides some hope. Teletherapy has been positioned as a democratizing form of care, says Hannah Zeven, Ph.D., author of The Distance Cure, A History of Teletherapy. It is long promised that it will open up the barriers to seeking mental health care in this country. That theory was tested during lockdown when receiving therapy remotely became the default. The good news is that research suggests that sessions over the phone or via video can be just as effective as psychotherapy done when people are in the same room, says Bufka. The less good news, only 5% of those surveyed for a Time Magazine Harris poll said they'd gotten mental health care for the first time during COVID, meaning the expansion of teletherapy didn't bring in large numbers of new patients. Technology on its own doesn't solve our current mental health crisis, says Zeven. For it to fully reach its potential, it must be supported by infrastructure changes that bring broadband access to remote areas and policy changes that allow therapists to practice across state lines and compel insurers to pay. Plus, each new technology that's introduced brings with it a unique set of issues. With text-based therapy, for example, there are privacy concerns. Where is that text stored? With chatbots, there is unease about the lack of a real human connection. To be fair, Wobot doesn't claim to be a therapist, more a coach or self-care expert. We do know that a lot of users express satisfaction with these technologies, says Bufka, which could mean the distinction between self-care and actual therapy may be less important to them than the convenience and, in the case of Wobot, the free price tag. As for Laura, her daily check-ins have been valuable. For now, it is something I will continue, especially for those everyday ups and downs. I actually feel better after using Wobot, she says, and I think that's an incredible use of technology. Sharna Cassell says by age 14, she was in therapy to work through the physical, sexual, and emotional abuse she endured during her childhood. Anything intimate freaked her out. She would panic if someone she liked made eye contact or called her beautiful. I thought that the level of anxiety that I lived with was who I was. It wasn't until I did somatic work that I was like, oh my God, this is just a response to trauma. Sharna, now 46 and a marriage and family therapist, psychotherapist, and master somatic coach, found somatic therapy at 24 after a decade in talk therapy. In those early days, she would find herself crying during a boundary-setting exercise that involved her shaking her head yes or no, but didn't understand why. I didn't understand then that trauma was stored in the tissue, and in that moment, I was responding as if I was in that past situation instead of sitting in a room in the present. Somatic therapy focuses on the body as well as the mind. Through grounding exercises to root clients in the present moment, relaxation techniques such as meditation, sensation awareness, and physical exercise such as dance or other movement, it seeks to make clients more conscious of their own physical presence and where in their bodies they experience their feelings. Peter A. Levine, PhD, is the author of Waking the Tiger, Healing Trauma, and the developer of a trauma healing treatment called Somatic Experiencing, or SE. He noticed that while all animals, including humans, experience automatic fight, flight, or freeze responses to threats, animals in the wild don't suffer the effects of trauma the way humans do. The problems start after a freeze, says his research. Our body still produces the same massive amounts of energy as it does for fight or flight, but while animals will discharge it by shaking and trembling after danger has passed, humans often thwart this process, stopping ourselves from crying or yelling, for example, which can cause us to hold the trauma in our tissue and can leave us in a state of chronic stress. Practitioners of SE believe that to heal, we have to complete this process and release that energy. This is done slowly with the therapist walking the patient through different moments, when they last remember feeling joy or when they realize they had survived a traumatic incident, and asking the person to notice and describe their body's sensations and positions. The therapist carefully watches the patient's physical reactions and decides when to plunge further and when to pull back. SE is not a form of exposure therapy. It specifically avoids direct and intense evocation of traumatic memories, Levine and his co-authors write in a paper describing the therapy and the research he used to create it. The thinking here is to avoid reliving the trauma over and over, which could lead to someone plunging deeper into it. Instead, SE practitioners gradually and indirectly approach charged memories and facilitate new sensations around them. SE was developed to treat trauma, but it can work for stress-related illnesses too. And while research is limited, there are papers that strongly suggest it's beneficial. One found that of the survivors of the 2004 tsunami in Thailand who underwent one or two sessions of an SE-based intervention, 90% reported partial to complete remission of symptoms 1 year later. While not new, EMDR recently made news when Prince Harry, Duke of Sussex, received the treatment on camera in his and Oprah's docuseries, The Me You Can't See. He explained that the trauma from the death of his mother was triggered whenever he was in London and manifested itself in feelings of being trapped. EMDR has allowed him to feel calm while visiting the city. After some initial assessment, EMDR patients are asked to revisit traumatic events while rapidly moving their eyes and perhaps performing repetitive tapping on their shoulders and knees. According to the APA, unlike other treatments that focus on altering the emotions and responses resulting from traumatic experiences, EMDR focuses on the memory with the intention of changing how it is stored in the brain. The result is a reduction or elimination in the problematic symptoms. Though how it works isn't entirely understood, it's thought that the eye movements or tapping re-stimulate the ability to process distressing events. Still, its effectiveness is clear, with organizations such as the APA recognizing EMDR as an effective form of treatment for trauma in particular and other disturbing experiences. Priscilla started EMDR after a toxic job left her questioning her abilities and feeling physically ill. For months, the 31-year-old says she endured gaslighting and insults from her inexperienced supervisor, who at one point even told her to see a therapist about getting on meds. Priscilla went to Human Resources with documentation of the incidents and asked for a supervisor change. Her request was denied. The situation brought up a feeling from her past of not being believed, so she and her therapist decided to explore that using EMDR. During the first session, Priscilla says she felt the venom dissolve. I pictured a container of water being poured into an ocean, and just that easily, something that had been so heavy my entire life went away. 5 years ago, Leah got the shock of a lifetime. Her good friend was murdered while out for a run. The violent trauma threw the formerly playful writer into a state of hypervigilance, super alert to her surroundings and fearful that people in her life would disappear. Talk therapy, EMDR, and antidepressants all helped, but it was a visualization during a psilocybin or magic mushroom ceremony that has had lasting effects. One of my therapists describes trauma as a scratch on a record that will always keep the music from playing until you smooth it out, she says. I had heard a lot about psychedelics as a tool for smoothing some of those deeply rooted trauma grooves. So in 2019, she attended her first ceremony. Lying on a mat in a room with a guide and a few other people, she embarked on her journey. She saw herself with a ball of black matter inside her stomach, which she realized was her trauma. As the visualization continued, she extracted the matter and held it in her hand. I saw that I could hold this experience close, have it in my hand and cradle it, but I don't have to be one with it. She credits this insight with allowing some playfulness back into her life. The new perception allowed a little bit of light to creep in, says the 31-year-old. While several U.S. states and cities have or are in the process of legalizing or decriminalizing psilocybin, it's not legal yet. The relief the drug brought Leah, however, is backed up by extensive and ongoing research. In 2019, the FDA deemed psilocybin therapy a breakthrough therapy. Institutions such as Johns Hopkins have research centers devoted to the study of it and other psychedelics. And this year, one study done by Imperial College London's Center for Psychedelic Research showed that two sessions of psilocybin therapy reduced depression more quickly than a six-week course of a leading antidepressant. But psilocybin isn't the only Schedule I drug, deemed by the DEA to have no currently accepted medical use and a high potential for abuse, showing promise in mental health care. MDMA, aka ecstasy, a synthetic drug that acts as a stimulant and hallucinogen, just took a big step toward approval with the release of MAPS, or Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies, Public Benefit Corporation's first Phase 3 trial. It found that 67% of participants who received MDMA in conjunction with psychotherapy no longer met the criteria for PTSD, compared with 32% of those who received therapy alone. What's remarkable about treatments with MDMA and other psychedelics is that they seem to help people work through their trauma instead of just dampening the symptoms. Your body has healing intelligence, explains Amy Emerson, CEO of MAPS. If you have a bad cut, a doctor might put those edges together, but your body does the healing. With MDMA treatment, she says, the therapist and the drug are there to put the edges together, but the brain and the patient do the work. Their use in clinical settings couldn't be further from dancing at a rave. There is conversation or journaling before and after to ensure intentions are set, and once on the drug, patients remain under the watchful eyes of mental health professionals. Study volunteers are also screened to exclude those who may have adverse reactions. Ketamine, another drug with a storied past, is also being used to treat depression, but it differs from psilocybin and MDMA in at least one important way. Ketamine is FDA approved as an aesthetic, making it legal for physicians to prescribe off-label for depression. A 2018 meta-analysis conducted by Carlos Zarate, MD, of the National Institute of Mental Health, showed that while antidepressants work 40 to 47% of the time and take weeks or months to take effect, ketamine has a 65 to 70% response rate for treating mood disorders and starts to work within 24 hours. One ketamine convert is Anastasia Burke. "I have always felt less than," says the 62-year-old. "If you look at me on paper, you'd see very positive qualities. I teach Pilates, I train horses, I've sold a book, and I've done all that while legally blind, which tends to inspire people." While she likes the idea that her story is helpful to others, it can also be a burden. What if they find out I'm a fake? On top of her imposter syndrome, Burke has had her fair share of trauma. In 2013, her sister committed suicide, and she suffers from chronic fatigue, a result of the same autoimmune disease that attacked her eyes. Then, in December 2020, she stumbled on the Addicted Mind podcast. The episode featured an interview with Dylan Bainan, founder and CEO of MindBloom, which offers clinician-prescribed guided ketamine therapy in 11 states. Before it was over, she was on the computer applying to be a patient. After weeks of interviews to make sure she was a proper candidate for treatment, she started therapy. MindBloom does its sessions remotely, so Burke was in her own bed with her husband nearby when she set her intentions to accept change as possible, put on the eye mask, and took the tablets that had been delivered earlier. "After that first session, I had a feeling of incredible well-being and wonder, a feeling of great openness. It was like my body had been all closed down and suddenly it broke open. I felt ready to take in anything good that came my way." At first, Burke needed to receive the treatment every 5 to 8 days to keep her depression at bay. But after 6 months of doing the hour-long treatments, as well as the daily prescribed journaling, she felt strong enough to taper back to going every few weeks. Then this past June, her newfound peace was tested. On her way back to her hometown to celebrate her mom's 80th birthday, she got the news that her mother had died due to pneumonia. A trip meant to be a celebration of life was now something else entirely. And if planning a memorial and sorting through her mom's things wasn't enough, Burke's brother re-entered the hospital for a heart condition the day before the service. "I am absolutely convinced that without ketamine and the tools I have implemented in my life through MindBloom, I would have completely fallen apart, started drinking, letting my emotions take over, and all in all, put in a dismal performance when both my mom and my brother needed me to step it up," she says. "I've made more progress in 6 months of working with MindBloom than I made in 40 years of other therapy." Fewer than half of the 20.6% of U.S. adults who experienced any mental illness in 2019 received care, which proves there is work to be done to ensure everyone gets the help they need. With researchers, practitioners, technologists, and academics expanding what it means to get help and developing different modalities to do so, the hope is that more people will find something that fits for them. Is it illegal to take psychedelics for therapeutic purposes? It depends on which psychedelic you're talking about. Ketamine, a powerful psychedelic, can be legally prescribed to treat certain mental health conditions, but that's the only one that can be prescribed on the up and up. However, that may change soon. "I've seen a shift in the medical, social, and political perspectives on psychedelics," says Ronan Levy, co-founder and executive chairman of Field Trip Health, whose mission is to heal people through psychedelic therapy. Institutions such as New York University, Johns Hopkins, and Yale are actively researching psychedelic treatments and their effectiveness. So how to find the right therapist for you? The right practitioner can make or break your experience. Lynn Saladino, PsyD, a therapist in New York City, shares tips on how to identify the right person. Treat it like a job interview. If you were hiring for a job, you wouldn't hire someone based on their resume alone. The same applies to a therapist. Before signing on with someone, ask for a 10 to 15 minute phone call to discuss your needs and get a feel for the therapist's demeanor. Ask about their treatment approach, familiarity working with clients like yourself, and educational background. Consider convenience. When it comes to finances and scheduling, being realistic about your needs will set you up for success. While you likely won't need to be in therapy forever, unless you want to, it still takes time. Before selecting someone, really consider whether or not you can afford their fee for an extended period of time. When it comes to schedule, think about whether a therapist who can only see people during working hours will fit into your day. If not, focus your search on someone with early morning or late evening appointments. If it doesn't feel right, move on. After a consultation, you might not know if a therapist is a good fit until you sit down with them. Just like dating, you can have a great first date, but after a few more meetings, it may become apparent that it's not the right fit. Follow your gut and don't feel pressure to extend the treatment longer in hopes that it will improve. Yes, therapy can be uncomfortable, but feeling a mistrust or discomfort within the therapy dynamic rarely leads to successful work. Our next article by Nadine Jolie Courtney and Melissa Goldberg is titled, Unique Thanksgiving Traditions Your Family and Friends Will Adore. Write down what you're thankful for. In all the fun and frenzy, it can be easy to forget the true meaning of Thanksgiving, gratitude. Dole out black Sharpies and before digging in, invite each guest to write what they're thankful for on a butcher paper cloth laid over the table. You can archive the sheets to look back on fondly. Set up a Bloody Mary bar. While the dinner's roasting and baking, set out a Bloody Mary bar so guests can make their own brunch classic as they mingle and watch the parade. Bonus points for over-the-top garnishes like bacon, shrimp, and lobster. Connect with family members far away. One of the few upsides to last year's downtime, there are now more ways than ever to connect with your nearest and dearest, no matter how far they may be. Keep that going this year and invite anyone who can't make it to your gathering to join in on the festivities, virtually. Set up a virtual happy hour or a video call before, after, or even during your meal with those who can't make it to the table so they'll feel like they're there. Watch the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade. Just in case you needed another reason to take part in one of the oldest Thanksgiving traditions, aka the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade, consider this. Following a scaled-down 2020 event, the nearly 100-year-old parade will return in its full form this year, complete with live musical performances, marching bands, iconic giant balloons, decorated floats, and yes, an appearance from Santa. Plus, you can enjoy the festivities from the comfort of your couch, ideally while sipping a mimosa. Collect canned goods. It's only natural to demonstrate gratitude by trying to give back on Thanksgiving, but instead of volunteering at a soup kitchen, many of which are overrun on that single day but then forgotten about later, why not invite your guests to each bring canned foods to donate? Make personalized place cards. Before the big day, send around a guest list and ask everybody to share one thing they love or respect about each guest. Compile the compliments on a place card with each guest's name so they'll sit to find a heartwarming list of anonymous appreciation. Keep a gratitude jar. Make Thanksgiving a 365-day affair. Throughout the year, keep a gratitude jar of gestures you appreciate from family and friends you know you'll see in November. Pull out the jar post-dinner and share the gestures that warmed hearts. Organize an ornament exchange. When Santa's sleigh appears at the end of the Macy's parade, the festive holiday season officially begins. For those who celebrate Christmas, invite each Thanksgiving guest to bring an ornament to exchange to kick off the holidays and keep the joy going through December. Watch a classic holiday movie. Stave off turkey coma by gathering together in front of the TV after dessert to watch a classic Thanksgiving movie together. Pick the same movie every year or have fun letting a different family member choose the film each time. Craft a beautiful centerpiece. Few things are more annoying and potentially disastrous for Thanksgiving hosts than having too many cooks in the kitchen, literally. So to keep your guests entertained while you finish whipping up the big feast, ask them to create a show-stopping centerpiece for the table. Depending on how much time you're trying to kill, you can either set up everything your guests will need, fall-hued florals, pint-sized pumpkins, wispy branches, multicolored gourds, scented pine cones, a few fallen leaves, or you can send them outside first to forage for some seasonal supplies. Play a game of charades. Get your friends together post-dinner for a good old-fashioned game of charades, sure to bring on the giggles and impress you with skills you never knew Nana had. Host a Thanksgiving potluck. No need to spend hours in the kitchen solo. Everybody's got their superstar recipe, the one passed down through the generations or borrowed from friends that they swear by. Get guests into the fun by inviting everybody to bring their best dish. As long as you've got all the major bases covered, who says you can't have four different types of stuffing? Ask everyone to make a Thanksgiving toast. A twist on the popular everybody say what you're thankful for, encourage each guest around the table to stand up and make their own Thanksgiving toast reflecting on the previous year. Share beloved family stories. Instead of fighting your food coma with lots of screen time, from watching a few episodes of the latest Netflix show to mindlessly scrolling through your Instagram feed, ask your older relatives to share a few of their favorite family stories. The activity will not only fill the evening with laughter and possibly tears, but it will also create deeper bonds that last long beyond the holidays. According to Emory University's Family Narratives Lab, families that know and tell family stories are emotionally closer and report stronger connections than families that don't know or tell these kinds of tales. We have run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I'm Brandi Spragata, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Oprah Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.